Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
And soybeans spiking to multi-year highs. Spain bond prices are blowing out and earnings season has begun. Revenues have been quite lackluster. And to talk about this, we have Professor Eiken Green from the University of California, Berkeley, and Tommy Grisafi from the Indiana Grain Company. All this and more on episode number 272 for the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hey there. Happy July. It's the week of July 23rd, 2012. And I'm Andrew Horowitz. We're going to be talking to you about a lot of stuff today and have some great guests lined up to talk about what's going on in Europe, what's happening with the grains, what's happening with crops, and what does that mean for stocks? Lots of things have been really hitting the news wire that I want to go over with you, and we're going to bring in our guests and talk to them as well. But I got to tell you something. We've had some amazing moves on stocks recently, and earnings season is that time of year that you do see the incredible moves, because what has happened is analysts are guessing at best what they're going to show for earnings, EPS, and for revenue. And we saw that over the last several weeks prior to earnings season, that analysts had been dropping down significantly their EPS and revenue estimates. So what happens is that naturally, you know, the companies get the numbers and they kind of look at what's going on and they talk with the analysts, and miraculously you see this 1 and 2 cent beat all the time on EPS. So we're seeing a lot of EPS beats, which is really good, but at a very lowered base. In other words, we're seeing them beat kind of, I guess it'd be the equivalent of going to a limbo contest and, you know, hey, they made it under the bar, but the bar was set really high, or, you know, jumping over a hurdle, but the hurdle was pushed down very low. However you want to look at it, the bottom line is that we are seeing a significant slowdown both in economic reports and numbers, in manufacturing. The Philly Fed was awful last week. Consumer confidence is coming down. GDP is being marked down dramatically. Inventories are on the rise. Retail sales have been dropping, and that is only in the U.S. We're also seeing soft numbers out of China, Europe, Brazil, India. And what that says is that there is some confirmation that the global slowdown is, in fact, building some steam, you know, building some energy that is moving in the direction of a continuation of the slowdown. Now, mind you, there is a separation, and you have to keep this in mind. There's a separation between what's happening on the economic front and what's happening with stocks, because stocks have been able to, companies have been able to really cut down on their expenses by laying off a lot of people, by adding technology, by doing a lot of refinancing of their debt and doing it at very low numbers, and by acquiring other companies. And that has actually allowed them to have a better earnings outlook, because they streamlined the businesses and they created synergies with other companies and other products that were maybe overlaps. And that has been very good. But the question still remains, how long does that last? How long can it be until we see that the revenue decline or the stagnation of revenue is going to affect the EPS, the bottom line? Because what happens here is that, in effect, when you cut expenses and you lay off people, there's kind of a wall that you're going to hit eventually. There's a maximum amount of expenses that you can actually cut, and then there's no more to cut. And then you have to keep that revenue high. So a lot of people ask me, they say, wait a minute, you know, with revenues not growing, how is it that companies can be profitable and look really good? And I say it's very simple. You have a situation where, let's say that you and I are in business, and we make $1 million a year, but we have $1 million of expenses a year. Well, we have no profits. But let's say, for example, that we don't grow our revenues at all. Over the next couple of years, we don't grow revenues. And we still make $1 million a year. But somehow, miraculously, we cut down on our expenses by 50%. So now we have $500,000 of expenses. So all of a sudden, with the same revenue, our earnings are a lot higher. So you and I are getting, if we're partners, $250,000 apiece. And what that means is, very simply, that we're much more profitable. So however you want to look at it, you've got to be really careful. Revenue is very important, but we also have to look at margins. We have to look at the EPS number, and we have to look at not only the expectations compared to the results. So in other words, what analysts are saying things should be compared to what has happened. We have to look at what is the longer-term trend here. Now, we're seeing that margins are holding pretty well, although a lot of companies are guiding lower. And this is a big concern of mine because what we saw last week was something very odd. We saw many companies guiding lower, stocks down on that information, but turning around within hours. F5 is a great example of this. Intel is a great example of this. F5 came out with numbers. They guided lower. Intel guided lower. Margins were a little bit squeezed lower. Stock was down on that news, but somehow buyers stepped in the next day and made the price, you know, rise. They were bidding it up. Well, just one day later on F5, after it was down about 7% after hours, you know, it came back up 5% in the regular session the next day. And then when markets got a little bit cranky on Friday, F5 dropped about 6%. So what we're seeing right now is, I think, a good amount of short covering, fear. Fear of not getting in for the next move. And people taking the information that they're seeing for granted and saying that, you know what, the management says this, but we really think they're going to do better. They're lowballing the whole situation. But when we see company after company guiding down, particularly in the technology space, saying that Europe is soft, North America is soft, China is soft, that should be a red flag that you need to be cautious. That doesn't mean you need to freak out. That doesn't mean that you just throw everything out and, you know, you say, okay, I'm done. But you have to be cautious. So what we saw was, for example, Chipotle Mexican Grill comes out with earnings last week. And if you think about what we've talked about over the recent time, we also talked about how we were short Buffalo Wild Wings. You know, you look at the cost of the inputs. You look at corn pricing, meat pricing. You look at the droughts that are going on. I'm going to talk about some of that. I have some questions for Tommy Grisafi on that. But when you look at all this and you put it all together, you have to realize that there is a certain amount that the consumer can actually swallow. There's a certain amount that they can actually withstand if you can increase your prices. Now, Chipotle came out and said, hey, there is a definite food cost issue going on. You saw the growth slow down a little bit. And there was a big concern about the input costs for management. Stock dropped about 21%. I think it's the biggest drop it's had in I don't even know how many years in a one-day period after earnings. This was a darling of the momentum crowd. They, you know, this is a good stock. It's, as a matter of fact, we think it, you know, has some great potential, and it has been a real winner. Now, each and every time we saw Chipotle over the last several quarters say that there's going to be an issue with food costs, it drops down 5, 6, 7% and was bid up the next few days. I don't know if that's going to happen this time, but I'll tell you, that is a warning when it comes to the other restaurants that will be putting out their numbers next week. We have Panera, we have Buffalo Wild Wings, and a few others that will be actually reporting next week. So keep aware of that. So this whole problem with the big drought. Now, let me take you back. We wrote about this in our quarterly market commentary for clients probably a year and a half ago. And we talked about how when the Great Depression was here back, you know, a century ago or so, one of the big things that happened was there was a confluence of issues that happened that really kind of created this perfect storm. We had, of course, the bank situation here. We had the entire depression here. We had then a little bit of a lift in the stock markets. We then saw, following that, a breakdown in Europe and just devastation, which really then sparked off the depression. So we had a stock crash, then we had a rally, then we had the European situation happen, then the depression that combined with the Dust Bowl. If you look back in history and you look at what happened, there was a major drought that pretty much just devastated the Midwest. And that was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back when it came to the depression. There was just this horrible food situation that went on. And this all came together at once. And I got to tell you something, it's kind of spooky dooky that we're seeing this almost replayed to a T. We saw the banking situation here drop. Markets drop, into recession, out of recession, you know, markets start to turn over, European markets start to get a little cranky, and then we see a drought. I mean, you couldn't have scripted it any better to reflect almost exactly what happened, with some differences, but what happened? Banks here are, you know, being put under pressure because we're not believing their reports anymore. JP Morgan comes out with a report, it looks good, but you know, they're moving $500 million of losses till last quarter. They're restating this. And, you know, who knows what's really going on inside these banks? Bank America looked horrible. If you saw their numbers last week, they're down at the $7 range again. And, you know, you look at the overall dynamics of the market and you have to wonder, is the United States resilient? Can we just forget about whatever happens around the world and be our own island of profitability? I don't think so. When you add the fact that oil's back up on the move again, consumers are retrenching, and now you have this food cost issue, you know, don't forget the rising food costs were the major problem for the unrest in the Middle East, the Arab Spring that came up, which caused a lot of unrest there and oil prices to spike again. I think that's kind of what traders have in mind and what they think is going to go on, and the conflicts that happened recently with the bus explosion and Israel blaming certain parties and certain parties going after. It's just getting a little bit out of control here. Now, what we've also seen is, if you've noticed, I've talked about this many times, this kind of weird movement in the markets where, you know, at 315 or 345, you see this big ramp up or big drop of markets kind of all at once. And I've been bitching and moaning for some time with many of my colleagues. I'm like, what is the story with the 11 o'clock hour and the 2 o'clock hour and the 3:30? And there's like a bunch of times that almost to the hour and the half hour that all of a sudden you see spikes or drops in markets. If the markets are kind of moving up for the day, you see these big spike ups. And if they hold, they hold. If not, it fails. If the markets are on the downtrend, you see the opposite happen and a big sell-off at the end. And again, on the hour, 12 o'clock, 11 o'clock, 11:30 is big when the European markets close, 2 o'clock. You know what? I thought I was going a little bit bonkers with that. People think I'm a little crazy when I was saying that. You know, my friend and colleagues like, what are you talking about? I said, go look at the charts. Just go look at what's going on. Look at the daily moves. Now, wouldn't you know it? We see an article on Bloomberg dated the 20th of July that says hourly price swings whipsaw investors in IBM, Coke, McDonald's. And there's a whole discussion here that talks about that shares of international business machines, McDonald's and Coca-Cola swung between successive lows and highs in intervals that began near the top and bottom of each hour. While only IBM finished more than 1% higher, the intraday patterns weren't accompanied by any breaking news in the three companies, and there were $3.4 billion worth of shares that changed hands that day. Now, what's interesting is that the amount of shares that were traded was about 14% of the value of trading in all the Dow stocks in that day. So what's kind of interesting is there is something to this, and they're saying, hey, you know, it's probably some kind of algorithm going off, which I agree with. There is some kind of hourly or some kind of trending algorithm that is being fired on the hours, half hours, et cetera. And you don't know which way it's going to necessarily go. But there are some people saying, hey, you know what? It's conceivable that there was an algo involved, but most don't run on the half hour. And this is a gentleman over at Baruch College who says that he wrote an article in 2010 called Algos Gone Wild in the Journal of Trading. He said they run a couple of minutes or so or seconds or even faster. And that doesn't make any sense. It doesn't seem like something you would see with a normal algorithm. So now this being an investigation, the SEC is looking into this. You know, it's always after the fact, right? Always, you know, something has to happen and then they have to look at it because they can't seemingly do this on their own. You never get the SEC seemingly looking at something without somebody complaining or somebody coming up with this and pressing it really hard until they do something about it. Just look no further back to Madoff, where the SEC really was begged to take a look at this because something was not right. And they looked, and they said, nothing's wrong. They looked, nothing wrong. They looked, nothing wrong. And it took until Bernie Madoff actually had to come out and say that the whole deal was a fraud and a Ponzi scheme for 20 years for this deal to actually be recognized by the SEC. So unfortunately, the regulators have their hands full. There's a lot of bad doers out there. But at the same time, you know, hopefully, I don't have faith in this, but hopefully the Dodd-Frank will create some additional funding for the SEC and the various regulators. Because, you know, when we look at what's gone on with LIBOR, we know that the U.S. was very much aware of what went on. The European area was aware of what went on. They let it go on. They let it go on until, you know, something happens that they have to do something about it. Now, I will tell you that I got to give some kudos, actually, to Frank Curzio. Last week when he was on, he said something very, very interesting. And if you missed it, I'll let you know. He said that when you look at Cheniere Energy, LNG as a symbol, you know, you have to look at all the things that are going on there. And he believes there was going to be another share offering that was going to be coming out, a secondary, to raise money so they can continue on the process of raising money and then building out the various shipyards and facilities, et cetera, for liquefied natural gas. He said that on a Sunday. On Monday, or maybe it was Tuesday, Monday or Tuesday, there was a 20 million share offering by LNG that dropped the stock down about 7%. Interesting. But I got to give him a little hat tip to him and some kudos for that very much wise information and very much on the ball when it comes to looking at the company from a historical perspective and what they were going to need. So that was really good. We had some of that. We actually sold our shares last week on, it was Tuesday or Wednesday. As a matter of fact, we did a total portfolio reboot for our trading portfolio for the TDI managed growth strategy, because what I was seeing was a tremendous amount of kind of wonky movement in individual stocks that were not representative of what the reality was, the kind of stretch between pricing of a stock and fundamentals and levels that were at all reasonable. And what we did was we did an entire portfolio reboot because we felt that, you know what, we're going to a much slower time in terms of markets or economies, and there's a lot of frenzy going on right now for undue reasoning, and many of these stocks are moving for really reasons that were unjustifiable. So what we did was, and this was building for some time because we've really been very disgusted and very disappointed with performance over the last 6 weeks or so. And we said, you know what? Sometimes you just have to step aside, take a pause, refresh what you're doing, look at it objectively, which you do all the time, but you have to kind of sometimes to say, you know what? We're going to put this whole thing on pause right now and then rebuild. So what we did was we actually sold most of the, or all the longs, except a couple, over the few days between Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday of last week, and then added back positions that met certain criteria. And what we did was we tightened up our screens. We looked at fundamentals in the way that we always would, but actually what we said was we want higher amounts of shares traded so we don't get caught in a liquidity situation. We want to tighten up some of the parameters on, let's say, ROE or earnings and revenue, and kind of made it a little bit of a tighter overall screening process, filtering process. And that was good. It happened to work out fortuitously very good because Friday was a really bad day and we were short the market that day coming in because we left some of the shorts on and a short hedge on. So that worked out really well, and then rebuilt on some of the big price drops that happened at support levels, small amount. So we're going to kind of look at this as a point where markets are very vulnerable right here. Yeah, there could be some ups and downs, but they are very vulnerable right now. We're seeing this kind of distribution process that lays off for a couple of days, that comes back pretty hard, then lays off for a couple of days, it comes back really hard, and a lot of pockets of like air in the charts. And that's not a really comforting area to be in when it comes to indices and individual stocks. So we'll talk about some of those pockets and how to identify those. You know, we've been having the Trigger Point Research webinars. There's one coming up this Thursday. As a matter of fact, the breakout class will be at 11:30 in the morning, and it's going to be a GoToWebinar. If you want to sign up for it, you can go to the show notes for this particular podcast, and it'll be in there. As a matter of fact, we use GoToWebinar. They're a great sponsor of ours. And we use GoToWebinar, and this is part of the GoToMeeting family of Citrix. And what we do is we actually screen share with you and have polls, which is really neat, and questions, and we can go back and forth and communicate and have a discussion that gives you not only a viewing of our screen or PowerPoint presentation that we're providing, but Steve Dahl from Task Market Profile and myself will be actually presenting together, so that you can find out a lot more about really where are those really good support and resistance levels that you should be looking to initiate positions off of or taking profits from. We've done this kind of thing over the last two webinars. We talked about the first one, the Trigger Point Research Alerts. Then we talked about the market trend indicator. And now we're going to go a little bit deeper into some of the behind-the-scenes look at actually how this algorithm works. And Steve Dahl is going to present some of that. So if you want to sign up for that, there's a little bit of room left. It's free. It'll be 11:30 in the morning Eastern time. You just go over to the show notes for this week and click on it, and you'll get right to it, and you'll just sign up for it and put your email in there. But that's from GoToMeeting. That's why it's so great. And as a matter of fact, you can get your particular freebie. You can go to GoToMeeting.com, get 30 days of free GoToMeeting. You can try it free by just clicking the button that says try it free. Use the promo code podcast, and you get 30 days of unlimited use of the GoToMeeting, which is a great service. And I thank them for being a sponsor of the show. You know what? I thought what we'd do is let's get over to our first guest, which is Professor Eiken Green. And I have some questions that I've lined up for him to talk about some of the things that are going on in Europe, because there's some things that I really need some explanation with that I think that he could answer with regard to what's going on with LIBOR, you know, what really was the behind the scenes, what's happening with Spain, and kind of the outlook from his perspective. And I thought we would do this from someone who's not an investor necessarily, but an economist who studies this particular area. So without further ado, next up is Professor Barry Eiken Green, professor of economics at the University of California, Berkeley. And we have been going back and forth trying to schedule this, so I'm very happy to have you.
I'm happy to be here.
So let's talk about Europe. I know that's something that you've been very much looking at and involved in. Many of the things they've done recently have seemingly been positive for investor sentiment, but is any of it really going to be, have any traction?
Well, I think the investor reaction we've seen has been positive on impact. And then as investors have had time to digest the details, they've turned negative about what the Europeans have done with good justification. So the latest example of this would be the summit at the end of the month of June. The Europeans said, we recognize that you can't have monetary union without banking union, and we have therefore agreed to create a banking union with a common European supervisor and a mechanism for injecting capital into banks that need it directly without going through governments. The markets reacted very favorably because they agree, rightly so, that you can't have a monetary union without a banking union. We have the dollar in all 50 states, and we also have the FDIC to deal with bad banks, and the Europeans need the equivalent. Ever since, the Europeans have been backtracking. The German Bankers Association doesn't like the idea that they'll be supervised by a European authority rather than a German authority. The German taxpayer doesn't like the idea that they're going to have to pay money into this insurance and resolution fund for bad banks. The German government doesn't want to let the Spanish government off the hook in terms of being responsible for the money that is now going to be injected into the Spanish banks. So political disagreements came to the surface, as they always do in Europe. And frankly, the whole thing is a mess.
Now, one of the things that I find really astonishing is that it appears to me that in Europe, whatever rules that they make, whatever contracts that they bind, whatever agreements they come to, seem to be okay until they're not, and then they're very happy to break them or do an end run around them. Example would be when the commentary where the EFSF or the ESM is not allowed to directly inject money into banks. They'll have to give it to the sovereign. Sovereigns are then responsible, and they can do what they want with it, in a nutshell. But yet, at the same time, then they give in, and okay, fine, we'll give money directly to the banks. Or, you know, this is just the confidence in the system, I think, is very much broken. Would you agree?
I would agree, and I think the what we're seeing is the contradictions of having a monetary union but not having a political union. So governments are reluctant to give up their sovereignty. They are therefore reluctant to make really binding agreements. So this history goes back a long way. It goes back at least to 2003, 2004, when the budgetary rules, the fiscal rules, were broken in Europe. And revealingly, they were broken by the big countries, France and Germany. The French and Germans thought that these rules about ceilings on budget deficits would apply to Greece or to Portugal, but not to them. And when they came into conflict with the rules. They said, well, we didn't really mean it. And I think that set a precedent that has been followed ever since. The European Union is a collection. It's certainly not a federation of states. So the German government can demand of the Greek government that they do certain things in return for receiving a loan. But the Greek government, at the end of the day, has the sovereignty and decision-making power about whether to go ahead or not.
Now, what in your opinion is keeping the euro as a currency relatively, it seems to me, higher than should be? With all the things that are going on around the world, it would seem that if a currency is reflective of the economy that it's related to, the European currency seems to be defying gravity in a way compared to where it should be. I know that that Germany has been the bright spot, and you're looking at German bonds and the stability of them. But if you look at the overall economy, it doesn't seem to be a realistic number of where it is. Is it that maybe China's pumping money in there to elevate it to keep their exports going? Is it that Sweden is and Switzerland or whoever, what's going on with this euro?
Well, I think there's no question that Europe is sicker economically and financially than, say, the United States, and that the euro should be weaker against the dollar, by all accounts. Indeed, a weaker euro would be a good thing for Europe. Mm-hmm. It would help with one of Europe's big problems, which is exporting, which is international competitiveness. The only rationale for the strong euro I can see, the only really convincing explanation, is that the European Central Bank has been slow off the mark. So its policy rates are still higher than the Fed's. They have been relatively slow to cut interest rates. They are reluctant to go back to the security market purchase program or to initiate a European version of quantitative easing. I think they will have to go there eventually, and we will at that point see the weaker euro. You would think that investors would look forward and they would realize that too, and that the euro, they would start selling euros now because they know the currency is going to fall in the future. So it is perplexing that it hasn't happened.
And one of the things that I find really interesting is that, when we do something here in our country to do some kind of a stimulus program, the dollar is sold off because obviously it is oftentimes a dilution of the dollar, if you will. But when something happens there, when you see that there's a massive amount of money pumped into the system, like the $1 trillion LTRO that was done, the euro actually spiked higher. It's kind of contrary to, common currency principles.
Well, I think the LTRO was exceptional in that it was liquidity provided to the banking system. And I think everybody knew that if it wasn't done last December, European banks would collapse, and that would be a very bad thing for Europe and for the euro and for the European exchange rate. So the LTRO averted the worst, and the euro did not weaken in response to that.
Let's skip ahead to LIBOR, which obviously is the topic du jour. When I think LIBOR now, the only thing that I can put together with it is if you were to flash me the word LIBOR, my response would be Machiavelli, in that it seems like the ends justify the means, in that they were trying their best to stay afloat, doing whatever they can, and then if the news breaks sometime in the future, it won't be so bad. I mean, we've seen this many times over with banks and with the Fed holding back who they actually gave money to back in 2008, 2009 for a number of years because they were afraid of the stigma that would be attached to it. And if you give a couple of years, nobody has any memory and everybody forgets, it's not a big deal and it's over and it's done. This LIBOR thing, is it much bigger of an issue than is being, led onto? And is this something that is going to be kind of mashed around and dealt with, or is it just something that's going to be swept under the rug, a few penalties put out, and then everybody's going to be on their way?
Well, it's a very big issue because it is one example of a larger phenomenon. There are a whole lot of benchmarks and decisions in financial markets that affect the entire system that are made by interesting parties. So LIBOR, as we know now, is not set by the markets in any sense. It's not set by the regulators. It's set by the banks in their own interest. Another example of that would be the decision of whether to trigger credit default swaps or not. There is a committee that which includes people who work for the banks and financial institutions that issue CDS that decide whether a credit event has occurred or not, rather than a disinterested third party. So the problem of self-dealing, if you will, I think is pervasive, and the LIBOR scandal is a wake-up call about that. Will it be swept under the rug? The extent to which other problems have been swept under the rug in the past makes you worry. But the Brits seem to be pretty darn serious about this, and more serious than the U.S. Treasury and U.S. regulators at, about coming clean on the problem and doing something about it. So we'll see.
One of the things about you mentioned there is about the CDS, and I think this is fascinating, and we'll wrap it up with this. But, you know, you look at all the maneuvers and all the funny names they put on the soft default, or, you know, these ridiculous stuff they came up with Greece's default just so they wouldn't trigger the CDS. And in my opinion, that was very detrimental potentially to the bond market, because if you go out and you're going to buy distressed assets and you say, okay, I'm willing to do so, but you know what, I want to buy some insurance behind it, and you know that there's going to be parties that are absolutely dead against creating an event because it would hurt their banks, it would hurt, why would you go out and buy the distressed debt?
Yeah, I think it's bad for the CDS market and potentially bad for the bond market, as you say. But look, contracts, believe it or not, are not always written stone. We have courts to decide about force majeure and decide about the interpretation and enforcement of contracts, and indeed about when contracts should be thrown out, even though they specified that party A would pay party B a certain amount on a certain date. So there's no reason why, I think, why CDS need be different. They need to be interpreted, and the circumstances surrounding their activation need to be considered. But for other contracts, we have independent courts that make the decision, not the principals to the transaction. And that's the problem with the CDS market and the LIBOR market.
Yeah, fun stuff. Well, I appreciate your time. Professor Barry Eichengreen from the University of California, Berkeley, spending some time with us today talking about all things Europe and all the wonderful things that are going to go on. I guess the last question I have for you is, the euro going to stand or fall?
Well, if you mean decline on the foreign exchange market, I would say fall. If you mean will there still be a euro in 10 years, I would say stand. It'll still be here.
Great. Well, I appreciate you coming aboard. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. We are with the one, the only, Tommy Grisafi from Indiana Grain Company. It's a great time to talk about things related to commodities, because things are going a little bit bonkers. How are you making out with this grain just craziness with corn and wheat? I mean, it's a nutty environment, Tommy, isn't it?
Yeah, it's been a little wild, Andrew. Someone wrote a letter. A guy at the Board of Trade wrote a letter saying that this could happen, and they laughed him off the exchange floor. But, you know, it's starting to happen. So this is the perfect storm. Just the equivalent to, like, Lehman going out of business and Bank of America. Not Lehman, but, you know, when Lehman went out of business and who else? I lose track. Bear Stearns. you know, that's like what's happening in the grains. And it's like the opposite. So usually when bad things happen, prices go down. But in the grains, I guess when bad things happen, prices go up. And things would be the drought.
The drought, yeah.
It's not a secret. Any housewife who watches Good Morning America knows there's a drought. And every news channel decided that, you know, that's the story of the day. And it is a big story. I don't poo-poo it. If you had 5,000 or 10,000 cows to feed, which a lot of ranchers do, the price of that grain just doubled in the last 15 days. And, you know, it's...
Uh-oh, trading coming in.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that's interesting, Tommy, is that...
Pretty hard to deal with. So luckily, you know, we're not on the we don't need the grain for animals. We just trade the grain, but it's been truly crazy.
So one of the things that's interesting to note is that, you know, let me just back up for a second and tell you that about a year ago, I had the opportunity to spend some time with, now his name's not coming to me. Begins with a G, too, from the CTFC.
Ginsler,
yes. I happened to corner him at a conference.
Mr. Ginsler, yes, sir.
And I cornered him. I said, you know, let me ask you a question. You know, what is the story with, you know, these just dramatic moves in gold or silver and all, and then at the end of the day, you find out that the exchanges change the margin requirements. I mean, doesn't it seem a little bit weird that during the day you see the big drop or the big rise and the big movement, and then at the end of the day, I mean, did somebody let the data? You know what he said to me? We don't really deal with that. We deal with leakage of data, like economic data and things of that nature we get really concerned about. I'm like, what? Amazing, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, there's a lot out there, and you know, the days of me having a badge and a jacket and walking down to the pit, and you know, the grains are trading 21 hours a day, and that's nothing. They should have been doing that a long time ago. But the markets trade all the time, and you know, it's just been crazy what opportunities there are, or, you know, for someone in another country to trade. I guess my point is, I'm still looking at these quotes from the grains at the end of the day and laughing, is that, you know, a young kid in Dubai who's 21 wants to trade, he can lease a seat at the Board of Trade or be a non-member and trade and be trading grains 21 hours a day, and that's a great thing. And, you know, if he's doing something wrong, he or she, tracking them down and disciplining them is a whole nother thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're having a hard time in this country just making sure that the firms we do this business through have money in them and are legit, let alone making sure the people who are trading them are legit and have integrity. And that's what the exchanges were based on, is all that integrity. So, it's a challenging time. Now, as far as this drought, it's interesting. It's going to shock people, Andrew. It's really going to shock people. And, you know, a smart guy like yourself should be really watching these ag stocks, John Deere, watch the people make the seeds. You know, maybe the people, watch the fertilizers, the people make the seeds. The equipment that puts the seed in the ground, and see how all that works. And if you start, you know, a lot of farmers I talk to are canceling tractors and combines. They're like, we don't even have anything to harvest, let alone need a new piece of equipment. So you know, someone else said, with the price of grains being this high, think of all the people that will order equipment in different parts of the world. So maybe those two equal each other out. You know, maybe there's a wheat farmer in Australia who wants all new equipment because he's just going to expand his acreage. So. But in the end, a few years from now, we'll have a lot cheaper grains. It's just getting caught up to this, you know, this move. So
what about like soybeans? I mean, soybeans has been, I think, at a record, right? Or close to a record?
They just hit a record today. Yeah,
right. So what's the story there? That's also the drought, or is that consumption issues? What's going on in the bean area?
No, it's China loves buying our soybeans. They have a lot of people to feed, and you can do a lot of neat things with the soybean. It's a great form of protein. So, and the whole world likes soybeans. And the corn was made at the end of July, but now the soybeans are going into their critical point where they need to be made, or, you know, whatever happens with you know, this continued heat or lack of moisture. So corn's already had a hard time. That's the price we're seeing. Soybeans are currently going through that. What happens, and
it's been the perfect storm, and then you got wheat and sugar and all that. I mean, you know, we've had this before, and one of the things that happened a couple of years back when all the food prices went up dramatically was really that whole uprising throughout the Middle East where food prices really escalated to a level that it could no longer be affordable. I mean, are we getting into that kind of zone again?
Yeah, it could. You know, the people it's going to hurt the most are the people who can't afford to pay for higher food, and that's just heartbreaking. So it's going to get scary. What stopped food from going up in 08 was the actual stock market crashing, and so that brought the price of everything down, and we went from like what looked like it was going to be an inflationary period to a deflationary period. So now we're getting to that weird type of 70s thing where prices start to go up, but what's different about this than the 70s is that we have zero interest rates. So we're going to see, like, food inflation, but you're not going to see it. You know, selling Treasury bonds might not be the answer to it. Eventually, we'll see some type of inflation here. But I think the Fed would actually like a little inflation. Sometimes the market trades a little better with a little inflation. But it's a very, very challenging time. So,
now, I don't know if this is your specialty, but you know, in terms of oil, there's been some calls by some ridiculous calls due to the Iran situation, due to all of the potential plays that are out there that, you know, you could hit somewhere in the neighborhood of $200 oil per barrel by the end of the summer. You know, we saw that big move down that was pretty dramatic in over the last, 2 months or so, when oil went from 100 down to, what, 75. Do you think that there's a real supply-demand issue that's really going to be driving this, or is this more back to the fear issue that is going to be, you know, escalating because of all the things in the Middle East, and that we may, in fact, see some kind of ridiculous number on oil again?
Well, that's a lot of questions, Andrew. Yeah. I wish I was that smart. I wouldn't be sitting here in Des Moines, Indiana, at a farm trying to figure out how where the next grain move's coming. But oil, I trade small on oil, and I'm pretty conservative. I'm a little more comfortable buying a dip than selling a rally, because it could go up a lot more than you think. And you know, as we say that, I sold some crude oil up 290 today, and it's up 240. So obviously, the long side of the oil. I think oil is also being dragged up right now because of what's going on in grains. So that that has something to do with it. And you know, it's just crazy. And the it's just a strange time. But you know, trading commodities is great. I don't want
to.
I don't like trading commodities, or you shouldn't trade commodities. It's just different than stocks. You know, you and I on the line before were talking about how boring stocks are. I mean, the whole world's trading Apple, and Apple is a commodity. And
So let me ask you something. In terms of what we talked about a moment ago, where you talked about how, you know, you look at some of the things that are involved around the grains. You know, you talk about the tractor companies, the seed companies, the fertilizer companies, things of that nature. I mean, there's, you know, a question of, hey, there's no... you know, we don't have it because of the drought, but does that mean that maybe the fertilizer, for example, Mosaic, Potash, Agrium, CF Industries are kind of interesting plays, whereas and seed companies like Monsanto, for example, and then, you know, you have to kind of stay away from maybe some of the companies that do the tractors in the U.S. specific, which there's not that many, and then, you know, look to possibly, you know, find an area that may be beneficial, or is there something that I'm missing there?
Well, no, I think they could have value, but the I think people are underestimating how much wealth is going to be lost by the farmers that were supposed to grow grain that didn't actually grow it. So I think part of the reason we're having this move is because of, you know, what's happened here in the last few weeks. So, I you know, I always felt when the economy was doing poor, the agricultural sector was hot the last 4 or 5 years. I think you're going to see agriculture get a little bit of a black eye, and it's not anyone's fault. It's Mother Nature, and you know we can't control that. So, but I'd say watch those stocks. I can't figure out where the money's going to come, if it's buying them or selling them, or you know, who knows. But one interesting thing that you should keep an eye out is that the people who make the seed, they've always been saying for years and years they put so much money in technology in the drought-resistant seed. Well, I don't know. You know, if you burn something, it doesn't grow. So, you know, these bags of seed are very expensive, and you know, it's going to be, you know, that might be what helps us have a better crop in the end, is that the seed wasn't as bad as you know, that the seed did better. So, you know, look for technology to make yields better.
Yeah.
So, but the hardware side of it too, you know, with the equipment, I don't like it. I wouldn't like owning John Deere here for the next 6 months. I'd take a break from it. It's been a great stock, but. You know, we got to see how bad of a black eye the American farmer has here. More the American rancher than the American farmer.
And how much the government will actually pony up, because usually when these kind of things happen, the government's very soft when it comes to giving money to the farmers, because they know how much difficulty they have, and it seems to be one of those plays that's almost an automatic. I think there was a resolution passed not too long ago, last week or so, that's going to actually give benefits to the farmers that have these problems as a, you know, a disaster benefit. You know, so, I mean, that's one of the other things. When it comes to, let's kind of skip ahead and talk about the liquidity and what's going on. So as you see it these days, obviously things have been very fast moving in the grains area. Is the liquidity still there?
You know, it's there's a lot of people interested in trading grains. And with the 21-hour trade in the pits disappearing, or not as not open as much as the screens open, there's a whole new group of person playing. So it's liquid, but it's in liquid like a commodity, like, you know, gold and silver. They're liquid, but they move too,
right?
And you know, it's very challenging. So
Interesting. Well, listen, we're going to wrap it up to take a little bit of your time today talking about, you know, the commodities, the grains and all that. Tommy Grisafi, the great Tommy Grisafi, Indiana Grain Company. I encourage you to go check out all the things that he does and he writes and all that. He's a great website. And we'll be watching the grains because there's a lot of things that go from there with restaurant prices and meals to, you know, issues, what happens in the Middle East and around the world in the poorer countries, how they get hit. So I think this is an important area to really be paying attention to.
Thanks, Andrew.
I appreciate your time, Tommy. Well, we know that the grain prices are moving, and we'll have to see really what the effect is going to be. But I'll tell you that the food inflation, if in fact we have not only this drought that's happening, but additional quantitative easing or any kind of push on the dollar, is going to be pretty dramatic, and we'll have to really watch that very carefully. So thanks to Tommy Grisafi. I do encourage you to check out his website over at IndianaGrainCompany.com. You know, I was thinking about some of the discussion we had with Professor Eichengreen, and one of the things I was thinking about was the whole idea of how, you know, this whole European situation where we're told that Spain doesn't need a bailout, and then 2 days later they need a bailout, and then we see that the ECB says that small banks in Spain may be defaulting, and then at the same time, about 2 weeks prior to that, we saw that there was a discussion how, you know, if that happens, that the ECB also says that there may be haircuts for bondholders. And that's really what's weighing on the euro right now. And the inverse relationship of the euro, or I guess not in the inverse relationship of the euro to the dollar, but the relationship of the euro to our equity markets is quite severe. As a matter of fact, we ran some charts last week and we saw that in lockstep on a tick-by-tick basis, on a daily basis when markets open, the euro really does have a dramatic effect. And what we're seeing is whether it's a program trade, whether it's a pair trade, there is almost a one-to-one match on tick with the euro move and the equity move. So we're seeing a lot of movement of markets based on ETFs and on futures flows. So that's one of the big things that you need to be aware of, because a lot of players are now saying, hey, we'll take some futures positions, maybe on the short side. We'll hold our stocks right now. And that's why stocks are being held up. But at the same time, sometimes markets are coming down. You know, you get vice versa. When markets come down and people are laying off their stocks, you see the big drops. But when you see in that markets come down, not a lot of drops in stocks, it's kind of like because of this hedged out situation. But I want to, you know, to keep aware that essentially we are being held hostage by the policymakers in Europe. And I don't know how you feel about that, but that isn't a real comforting position to be in as an equity investor. If you think about it right now, you know, a lot of times you hear that the bond market is really the smart market. They do all the credit analysis, and the bond market is the one to really be observed. And if you look at that, you have to realize that negative rates on German bonds and close to at the historically low levels on the U.S. 10-year, and the very low rates on any kind of developed countries that have good ratings are dropping like crazy. In other words, there's people piling into bonds. At the same time, you're seeing bank runs continue on in Spain, Greece, and all that. They don't think that Greece will actually be able to make the numbers that they had put out. The Troika is now meeting over there, and the next couple of weeks we'll find out if, in fact, they are eligible for the next round of bailouts. And at the same time, there's a lot of mixed messages going on. Europe is falling into a deeper recession. The UK is in a recession. And right now, it looks like there's just simply where do we put our money? We have to be in stocks if we're allocated to stocks. And what happens is that it goes into the U.S. So that's kind of what's going on right now. But again, I think that we have to be very mindful of the fact that there is a lot of distribution going on. And the fact of the matter is volumes are low, especially in the summer. So I want you to be very aware. Last week on Wednesday, we put up a chart on thedisciplinedinvestor.com and said, hey, is this the top of the market here? Take a look at some of these signals that are happening. Take a look at what's going on. And that was kind of the last straw in our portfolio reboot that we put together. One of the other things that I want to talk about is what we saw last week with the markets up the first couple of days. You know, we saw this kind of 7 day in a row markets were down in the U.S. And then we saw this dramatic rise out of nowhere with not much information to be really seen as great. And these reversals of stocks that went on, all that. One of the things that was really interesting was that short interest on the S&P 500 was at the highest it's been in the last couple of years. And what we've seen on a regular basis is that when short interest is really high, or when there's a lot of long positioning in whether it's commodity, oil, or It's in the equity markets on the futures side. When we look at the commitment of traders reports, it often serves as a contrarian indicator. Why? Just the way it is. Whether it's that somebody's looking to pierce the shorts and drive them higher or blow out the longs, whatever it is. But what's really interesting is that we saw this short interest ratio, which was increased due to a few things. It was further shorts being laid out, as well as the fact that we saw low volumes overall. So your short interest ratio or days to cover will increase. And what happened was that we saw this big short cover rally. And if you look at short cover rallies, you often find that individual stocks, for no reason, will move up dramatically, 5, 6, 7, 8% in a day, and then start fading back. And a lot of that had to do with the fact that there was a lot of investor optimism about some of the earnings that were really unfounded, in my opinion. And again, when you look at things like Microsoft popping 3% and being down 2% the next day, we'll see what happens with Google after their numbers last week, which was okay. Their numbers were good, not great. We saw the same thing with the banks. JP Morgan popped and then came back in. And we saw the same thing with many of other stocks in the technology area. eBay is probably the one holdout that did really well. And a lot of that had to do with their PayPal, their payment platform. And that was a big part of their income that has really been really doing very, very well, which is great. And so now you look at the markets and you have to consider, okay, so we had this really nice few days, which was taken out totally on Friday, or most of it was taken out on Friday. Where do we go from here? So we're in this choppy range. We're in this very big choppy range that you have to be very careful of. And one of the things I would tell you is that what I think is really a great way to look at this now is looking for when things drop down to key support levels and looking to pick up some there, partial position, adding on there when they kind of start moving and doing a bit of a trade up. In other words, they either bounce, if you want to call it, or what they do is they come off that support level is really some of the areas that you want to look at. Because when we get into that, a basing pattern, you know, look at Caterpillar right now in a basing pattern, it kind of dropped down a little bit, but it's right in that support zone right now. And if it continues to do so, it's coming out with earnings next week, but if it continues to do so and it holds on to that and there's any kind of indication that earnings are okay, you know, you should see a nice rebound on that. Now, of course, Caterpillar has a lot to do with what's going on in China, where they're really not buying the machines these days, it seems. They have incredible amounts and record amounts of coal inventory. They're not buying the steel. Steel prices are dropping. Aluminum prices are dropping. And the productivity over there is really held back by the fact that they've been trying to slow down their economy. And they have been successful. Everybody's whining about, oh, China's slowing down. They want to do that. They are trying to slow down their economy to stave off the inflation and to get pricing of housing under control. They've done it. Now, when are they going to stop? I don't know. We hear mixed messages. Finance ministers and the government talking about how they're going to continue to do what they've been doing when it comes to keeping a lid on housing, but yet they're doing a little bit of changes very incrementally when it comes to repurchase swaps, and they're also doing with the bank loan availability and interest rates. They're actually the Chinese currency, the yuan, has dropped dramatically. You know, it was on the rise for a while. I think it's down 4% in the last couple of weeks. So this whole idea that I never understood of how we're going to increase the yuan and then what's going to happen is you're going to see this domestic demand and all that. This whole thing with the letter of currency manipulation in Geithner's pocket and Schumer going off the handle about this whole manipulation and all that. And this, a lot of blowhard BS. Fact of the matter is that China is a net export economy. Yeah, you want them to build an infrastructure and then you want to have domestic demand. That's great. But the fact is that they are built to be an export economy. And trying to break the back of that in a time when things are slowing down is probably not the best thing that they can do. So dropping down the currency a little bit is not the worst thing we've seen. You see that the yen had hit a record high against the euro last week, as the euro is dropping, and the safe haven currency of the yen, which, again, this astonishes me that the yen is actually a safe haven currency with their debt load. But it is. It is because of this, generally their strong exports, which has been fading. But yet, there's not many alternatives right now. You know, do you want to be in Russia? No. Do you want to be in the euro? Not really. Do you want to be in the renminbi? No, not really. Do you want to be in you want to be in India? No, they're trying to drop things down, even though there's inflation and that's rising. You know, there's a lot of currency movement going on that really is the big problem right now. You know, central banks so involved in every aspect and every little bitty movement of this or that and the constant parade of people talking, this is what really is problematic with the economies right now. They're not letting things naturally progress. They're just, you know, it's the old, you know, watch pot never boils. You know, they're just not letting it do a holistic and homegrown natural process, because God forbid the stock market drops, you know, this new breed of central bankers all about the stock markets, you know, then there's a big problem. But you know what? It's just like anything else. We talked about this many times. You know, the forest needs to sometimes burn down for it to regrow much stronger and better. Now, we saw that with the U.S. stocks and particularly in banks. Yeah, we're seeing a lot better balance sheets right now. Of course, a lot of write-downs and some problems. But, you know, U.S. corporations basically burnt down to the ground. They said, you know what? That was a scare of a lifetime. We're not letting that go on anymore. We're not going to be in a position where we're going to have that happen again. So what they did was they totally took apart the old ideal of having all this. They cleaned up their balance sheets, a lot of cash on the balance sheets of companies, probably the highest of all time. They're not redeploying it right now because they really have an uncertain future. We don't know what's going to happen with this Obamacare. We don't know exactly what the ramifications are. We don't know what's happening with this fiscal cliff, by the way. There'll probably be 50 things that come ahead of this because they just don't want to face this in Washington. And this is a big issue. CBOE is talking about somewhere around, I don't know, a 5% knock to GDP if, in fact, the taxes are not extended, the tax breaks are not extended. President Obama wants to just do it for a certain set of people. Romney wants it for everybody or nobody. And now they're getting into a real pissing match here with the Democrats and the Republicans, and it's really an ugly situation because it looks like it's going to come to the 11th hour again, just like we saw with the debt ceiling. We'll see what happens. Anyway, we're going to post a lot of things this week when it comes to the ECRI, their levels of the economy. We have some posts going up about short interest, and we're going to have that webinar, and we're going to also put up some of the various stocks that we see that's happening. So keep a look at Twitter, and that's at Andrew Horowitz, and keep a look at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. You can do an RSS feed to that. You can just put it in your bookmarks, etc., and make sure to visit it as often as possible because we do update that quite often with a lot of information. Otherwise, I look forward to seeing you next week. Let's see what happens. Thanks for joining me. This is Andrew Horowitz. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented that should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.